you all for coming. I'm David Gordon. I'm going to be chairing this meeting this evening on economics and human rights, common ground or continual conflict. We have three very distinguished speakers here this evening who are going to each talk for 15 minutes, and then there'll be an opportunity for questions, and after questions you're all invited to come for a drink, but I'm not allowed to tell you where that is until after the end of the meeting. I'm a Professor of Social Justice at the University of Bristol, and I'm going to chair this meeting, as I said, and I'm very honoured to have been invited to do so. Not least because it gave me the opportunity this afternoon to exercise my civil and political rights along with 200,000 other people. Today is a day when human rights are in a lot of people's thoughts, not just because of the demonstration, but of course because of the tragedy of the bombings that have happened in Turkey this afternoon. One of the badges that I saw many demonstrators were wearing was Smash IMF, which is obviously a popularisation of some of the academic debates that we are going to be discussing this evening. There are some conflicts often between experts on human rights and economists, particularly on how social and economic and cultural rights should be fulfilled. There are, for example, some economists who are influenced by the work of Friedrich Hayek, who deny that social and economic rights are rights at all. They argue that civil and political rights and social and economic rights are not indivisible, as many human rights experts believe, but that civil and political rights are negative rights, where the state refrains from murdering or imprisoning people, where social and economic rights require resources, and they have an arbitrary level of resources that are needed, and that requires an arbitrary redistribution of resources, and therefore they are fundamentally different from civil and political rights. The counter-argument to that is often that civil and political rights also require resources in order to be fulfilled. They require criminal justice systems, police forces, voting systems, and therefore essentially they are conceptually similar. At a more fundamental level, many economists argue that in order to get distributional justice, you should follow utilitarian or equity principles. And that the equity principles, I mean that people should get the resources they deserve based on the work they are doing and the value of that work. But often, both theoretically and in practice, following these principles, such as maximizing the average wage, can lead to tremendous levels of inequality and poverty. And therefore, human rights experts often argue that different principles should be followed, different principles of distributional justice should be followed. Some argue it should use the principles of John Rawls, others argue that resources should be distributed on the basis of need or on the basis of equality. There's a whole range of different theoretical debates about how resources should be distributed in order to meet and fulfill social, economic, and cultural rights. So I've just laid out the background of some of the debates. We have a series of expert speakers who will put much more flesh on the bones and give their own positions. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker tonight, Timothy Beasley, who is director of the Stickard Centre at the London School of Economics. He is a research fellow at the Institute of Fiscal Studies and at the Centre for Economic Policy Research, and he is currently the co-editor of the American Economic Review. He is also currently a consultant to Her Majesty's Treasury, along with many other distinguished positions that he holds. So I will hand you over now to Timothy.
Thank you very much. Let me say at the outset that what I'm going to be seeking is not continual conflict, but common ground. Whether I'm successful in doing that will remain to be seen when the other speakers follow. I think that there's a danger that when one looks at how different disciplines and how different debates unfold, that one looks too much at the way they're described and insufficiently at what happens on the ground. And that's going to be a resounding theme in what I want to talk about. So I think it's fair to say that among standard economic analysis of problems, and particularly the problem of economic development, the language of rights surfaces very little. But I think it would be a mistake to conclude from that the human rights agenda, if one wants to call that, broadly speaking, a meaningful thing, that it has little in common with the concerns of economists. Economists care about health, education, democracy, happiness, the kinds of things that you or I probably all care about. It's unfortunate that many non-economists who characterize what economists do and what they care about do so on the basis of two broad misconceptions. One is that the level of understanding about how economics analyzes problems is the level of, I think, a broadly undergraduate first pass at the study of economic life, where it's true, that's broadly a caricature of the way we believe economies work. The second is, I think, a misplaced belief that there's anything such as an economic approach or economist's view of the world. Unfortunately, these misconceptions are fueled by the writings of people, for example, like Amartya Sen, who often, I think, put forward a rather straw man view of what economists believe, as if there's some evil Chicago-based economist out there who's driving all of the things in the world that we don't like. So I speak not for a discipline this evening, because that would be counter to the belief that I just aired. I have no idea whether any of my colleagues will agree with much of what I have to say. Only today, in fact, I enjoyed a heated debate with my colleagues on the merits of the Iraq War and the Bush-Blair relationship. The fact that we were both economists with broadly similar methodological predispositions was not the basis of any kind of agreement, I can assure you. It's not like economists always agree on these matters. So what we share in common, and what I think I want to push as broadly an economic approach to the world, and thereby to the issues that impinge on human rights, is rather a broad set of methodological notions about how to approach social inquiry. And I think most of the economists would go to the gallows defending these, as many of the other social scientists would be happy to send us there. My substantive comments this evening are going to fall into two parts. The first part is really how I can sort of put together an economic agenda which embodies many of the concerns of those who care deeply about human rights. And second of all, to talk a little bit about the China-India comparison, which I think is very telling in regard to those debates. The approach I want to put forward and to suggest is really broadly what I call an instrumentalist view of rights. It's a view that says there are constituents of well-being to which most of us, I think, would ascribe the need to be well-nourished, spiritual well-being, autonomy, happiness, whatever it is you think should be the components of that. But the rights should broadly be viewed as an instrumental basis for attaining those ends, rather than necessarily being the constituents of those ends themselves. That's not a radical position, but I think it's broadly the position that most economists would take. Now, I think economic research in recent years has been quite powerful in pointing out the way in which granting and changing certain rights to which individuals have access can have profound impacts on the way societies function and on the way in which resources are allocated. And I want to just name three examples of research agendas that I know about pretty well to try and illustrate, I think, how the kind of positive economic approach to the importance of rights can be built. Let me give you my first example from the study in political economy of the role of political reservation. Many of you won't know this, but India in the 1990s passed quite a radical but interesting reform in the political system to reserve one-third of seats in legislatures for women. This was viewed as an aim both to promote the rights of women directly, but also instrumentally. The notion was that women as policymakers have different policy priorities, and that the political process as constituted really didn't bring to the fore those interests. So what was done was to directly mandate representation. Now, when an economist looks at that experiment, they care really at some level not at all about the intrinsic value of that. What they care about asking is, well, let's go and look and see what happened after that experiment. Really, was it the case that putting political power in the hands of women in the way this was designed have a real impact on stuff that was going on the ground? The nice thing from a point of view of an experimentalist is that these things were actually done randomly. 1/3 of the seats was randomly reserved for women. You have something very close to what would be an experimental situation as normally studied by natural scientists. The studies that have looked at that have found, yes, indeed, changing the structure of power relationships within Indian villages is normally done at the level of what's called panchayats, which are very local governments in India, does indeed to appear to have changed the policy setting priorities. More expenditure, particularly on education, more on water projects. There are really definable outcomes coming from changing the structure of underlying rights. Now, that's the kind of approach to rights I think economists are very comfortable with. First of all, measurability. We can go out there and we can look at the world and we can quantify and look quite in targeted way at what's going on the ground. It gets away, I think, from what economists are suspicious of, which is broad claims that may or may not have any real impact on the world, that we can use the language of rights, but is that really changing any outcomes? Here we could really look at outcomes and we could say, yes, changing the structure of rights in that society in that particular way, of course it's some level of a very modest way to go about doing this, did have a real impact on the outcome. Let me give you another example, which I think has been the focus of recent research in economics, is the instrumental importance of press freedom. We are now, how I think, rather a good basis for looking at this in a variety of situations. That granting press freedom isn't just intrinsically important from the fact that we get to read newspapers that are perhaps a little closer to printing the kind of stuff we think is possibly truthful, but it may be important in really changing the kinds of policies that are implemented by policymakers. So in the work, again, I'll draw on some work on India, we observe that states that have got greater press freedom and greater penetration of newspapers really do appear to have policy-making climates that are rather different than those where this is underdeveloped. That here is a real issue where the right has an instrumental importance for the kinds of policy outcomes and therefore for the daily well-being of individuals. In particular, if you look at the responses to famines, floods, and other natural events, they appear to be much more dramatic in states where the press is better developed. Again, it's an instrumental view of rights, but it's a view that I think highly consistent with a very progressive agenda, saying that what matters is giving people the power to, in this case, discipline governments who don't respond, and thereby to enhance the value of the political rights that individuals enjoy. Because at a nominal level, the political rights enjoyed by individuals across states in India are rather similar, but here's a dimension in which it isn't. Let me give you a third example, is property rights, and the creation and protection of property rights. Hernando de Soto, as many of you know, is famously argued very strongly that one of the key ways to promote economic well-being is to give individuals who have highly insecure rights to particularly the land that they occupy or the houses that they own, is a great source of economic underdevelopment. And he argues this particularly in the context of Latin America. But again, thankfully, we're now able to go out and evaluate such claims because there are land titling programs, attempts to give people access to land and access to the process that creates land to enhance their rights to such things that allow us to ask whether this has an impact. And indeed, the evidence is broadly suggesting that there is a significant impact on economic well-being and other dimensions of well-being, access instrumentally then to education and other things by granting people more secure and better rights. So I think the notion that we can study this within an economic framework and to provide very specific evidence that this is an important agenda, I think pushes enormously forward the whole debate about human rights in a way that the sort of generalized discussion can quickly appear platitudinous. If economics has a contribution to make that I think is going to move the debate along, it's precisely because we can produce an evidence-based and I think persuasive account of where these things have made a difference. Now perhaps on to a slightly different theme, which is quantifying the value of political rights. I think one thing that economists for their sins have in common is the almost genetically predisposed need to quantify anything that they see. What about quantifying the value of rights? It might seem like a heinous thing to do or even something one couldn't do. So I worked with one of my students, Sylvia Pazzini, this afternoon to look at the World Value Survey. Because last weekend I was at an IMF organized conference, you can boo and hiss now if you wish, it was called a Tale of Two Giants, and it was a comparison of the Chinese and Indian growth performance in the past 2 decades. And as many of you know, the striking thing about China is it's been one of the fastest growing economies for the last, at least last 10 years, and over a 20 year period has reduced poverty very, very dramatically. At the same time, India seems finally to be attaining a if not comparable, but a historically high level of growth. Of course, the striking feature is the human rights situation of those two economies. China has managed to secure this almost unprecedented reduction in poverty and growth in national income without substantial liberalization of human rights. Indeed, if you look in the data, quite the opposite. If you look at any rating, Freedom House or whatever you want to look at, you will find that China actually is less free in 2000 than it was in 1980, basically as a consequence of the Tiananmen Square episode. India, by contrast, has always enjoyed a very high level of rights, but at the same time has enjoyed a comparatively miserable level of economic growth. And only very recently does it appear to have got to a situation where growth is going to rise above what's often called the Hindu rate of growth, which is 2%. And yet, to do anything about the problem of long-term poverty in India, one really needs much more substantial rates of growth. Okay, so where can I reflect on this in terms of my quantification of political rights? So slightly mischievously, I thought, let's look in the World Values Survey. We have data on India and China, and they ask a number of questions, attitudinal questions, about how people rate their personal life satisfaction or their happiness. There's a number of questions. You can say, how happy do you feel on a scale between 1 and 4? This is a very well-established survey instrument and is some ways, some people attach more weight to it than others. I believe Tony Blair currently has a guru sitting in 10 Downing Street who tells him, you know, this is how much more people are going to be happy if you do X or Y. So he's certainly bought into it. Economists have traditionally been very, very skeptical about attitudinal data on happiness. But even so, it'd be interesting to take a look in the World Value Survey. So what we did was simply to basically look in the data and say, can we find any evidence that income per capita and political rights are correlated with people's answers to the question of how happy they feel? And if you look at a sample based on China and India, and I don't want to, you know, this was something done in an afternoon, so I don't want you to take away from here there was great science afoot, but I think methodologically it raises a number of important points. It turns out that India and China, you find that essentially happiness is strongly positively correlated with political rights, and that it's positively correlated, thankfully, you might say, for an economist, with income per capita. But what it gives us is a measure of what an economist would call the marginal rate of substitution. How much extra happiness do you get relative to, if I give you a bit more income, what can I do to your rights to give you the same constant level of happiness? It gives us a quantification of the relative value of human rights. Well, you'll be pleased to hear what the answer was in this. It turns out that the mean level of happiness in both countries is actually around 3 on a scale of 1 to 4. But if you took India and gave India, if you took India and gave them China's political rights, that would fall to around 2. So in a sense, a one-third reduction in this rather odd thing, the measure of happiness. If you gave India China's income per capita, it would go from about 2.98 to 3.08. In other words, it would barely move at all. The data suggests that China may have had this prolonged period of economic growth, but that's barely, based on these estimates, going to have changed this measure of well-being, albeit a faulty measure of well-being at all. But if you'd repress the Indian people in the same way as the Chinese people have been repressed and denied their rights, that would have had a very, very substantial negative impact on the well-being of India. Now, I say that these are the kinds of debates that I would hope economists would have with people who care about human rights. I would care that we find a way of valuing these things, that we don't become fundamentalists and believe there's no way of thinking about, is there a trade-off between generating economic growth and human rights. I think when I look at China and I look at India, I'm very struck by the fact that if you look at the history of their performance and what they've achieved economically, one country has done it without the liberalization of rights. And if you talk to high-level Chinese officials, and many of you may have done this, and ask them, what is the danger of liberalization? They say our growth is what we'll lose. You know, basically they're terrified of what they call the problem of chaos. You know, that basically it will unleash forces that the society will tear the society apart. But I think if we're going to think about the link between economic performance and rights, it really brings it into sharp relief when we think about these two giants, the two countries in the world that account on a dollar a day poverty measure for around two-thirds of world poverty. Anyway, I think it's fair to say economists don't wear human rights on their sleeves. But I don't think there's really any conflict between economic analysis and economic approaches and believing in the broad kind of agenda that people who do care about human rights and talk the language of human rights believe in. I think it would be a mistake to believe because we don't use the language, we don't share the concerns. I think our contribution to the agenda is potentially to examine in our methodological framework the consequences of changing the structure of rights that people enjoy. And I think we have both the expertise in analysis of data and I think some expertise in the analysis of certain kinds of questions to think we can make a contribution. In that sense, I don't think we have anything but a common ground. There is nothing intrinsic between the rigorous study of economics and economies and believing in the promotion of a rights-based agenda.
Next distinguished speaker this evening is Professor Geraldine Van Buren. She is Professor of International Human Rights Law at both Queen Mary and the University of Cape Town. She is a barrister at the Doughty Street Chambers and is a Fellow of Goodenough College. She is also one of the drafters of the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, which is undoubtedly the world's most ratified and signed human rights treaty. It's been signed by every country in the world, I believe, and ratified by all countries apart from Somalia and the United States of America. She is also has acted as a consultant to the United Nations and the Commonwealth. And I'm very glad to have her here to speak tonight, particularly since it's the International Day for International Rights of the Child Day.
Well, happy International Child Rights Day. I was glad to see so many people out on the street marching in support of international children's rights today. Very impressive. The words lawyer and compassion rarely appear positively in the same sentence. But international human rights law is very different. International human rights law is the human face of globalization. It's a peaceful but powerful, effective way of change. And I want to argue tonight that not only are economics and human rights not intrinsically in conflict, I want to propose that it's only if economists and human rights activists start working together can we start making the eradication of poverty an effective goal. Now, in South Africa has discarded many of the myths surrounding human rights. This division between civil and political rights as a first generation, economic, social, and cultural rights as a second generation. The myth that civil and political rights are cheap, which they're not. If you're going to set up a due process, legal protection of defendants, interpreters, very expensive system, and economic, social, and cultural rights are always expensive. They brought together all these rights in one constitutional document and made them subject of the court's jurisdiction. Now, a group of economists have just started to bring a case under the South African Constitution. They're called Economists Against the Arms Trade. And they're taking the South African government to court. They're arguing that an arms trade agreement actually violates the constitutional rights because by spending so much money on submarines, weaponry of a very sophisticated kind, the South Africa will be unable to implement its rights to education and its rights to health of the citizens. Now, some of you may be surprised by such a case, but there's a lot of legal support for this kind of approach. Firstly, when a state becomes party to a human rights treaty, such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that's a political decision. Once it becomes party to that human rights treaty, then that treaty starts to set limitations on the budget of the country. It's a binding legal obligation to implement free primary education. And so we need to start working with economists, starting to look at the impact of these budgetary implications. Secondly, defense used to be a no-go area, a bit like the division between the public and the private spheres. It was argued you couldn't challenge what the government was spending, policies on defense, because that was a matter of state sovereignty. executive discretion. However, when Egypt and Indonesia appeared before the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, they actually started to receive a little bit of a shock, because the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child refused to accept this defense of unaffordability. They looked at the proportions that Egypt and Indonesia had spent on defense, and they looked at the proportions that the governments had spent on social justice expenditure, and they criticized the governments for spending too little. So it's the proportions that count, not the amount. And one of the problems for courts and human rights tribunals is to be able to distinguish between a state's genuine inability to afford the protection of certain rights and unwillingness. And now new tools are being developed. Firstly, we have this notion of human rights budgets. That does not mean the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Secretary of State for the Treasury stands up one day and gives the national budget and the next day gives the budget for human rights. What it means is that the budget is starting to be disaggregated according to how much is being spent on health and the prevention of infant mortality, how much is being spent on the juvenile justice system. And this is giving lawyers new tools, and we've got to start learning to work in this very new multidisciplinary area. The second tool is the notion of a minimum core. This idea has been promulgated by the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And the UN Committee has argued that every state, it doesn't matter how poor, has to implement a minimum core of each of the rights protected in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Minimum cores in terms of clean drinking water, in terms of right to shelter. And so this is moving forward in very effective ways, the protection of economic, social and cultural rights. It's still not up there with civil and political rights because it's a new area. But courts are beginning to gain confidence from this growing case law. And in Venezuela, the Venezuelan Supreme Court refused to accept the Minister of Health's argument that he could not afford to provide free of charge HIV and AIDS medicine. The court scrutinized the budget, scrutinized the arguments of the Ministry of Health, and suggested to the Ministry of Health two ways by which it could afford to do so, and suggested that it chooses one of those two ways and presents it to Parliament for the next budget. Now, the South African government was also taken to court, some of you may know, on its refusal to provide naviraprin, which is a very low-cost drug which prevents mother-to-child AIDS transmission. Now, in South Africa, 24% of all pregnant women are HIV positive. So this case has had major ramifications. The government firstly argued it was not the court's role to prescribe a specific drug. They argued it was a breach of the separation of powers. The Constitutional Court responded that as economic, social and cultural rights are included in the Constitution, it was its constitutional duty to protect them. And there are no bright lines dividing the separation of powers. The separation of powers moves as countries become party to human rights treaties, as they incorporate economic, social and cultural rights into their Bill of Rights. And they ruled that the South African government actually had a constitutional duty to implement reasonable measures to protect HIV-positive women. What the government had done was only provide drugs at 18 test centres. These test centres were unavailable to the majority of the population. It was almost like a lottery of geography, a baby's life depending on the lottery of geography. And the court ruled that this was unreasonable. So we need to get economists and human rights lawyers together, lobbying together, firstly, for the inclusion of social justice rights in national bills of rights. Because human rights has shed its old skin. It's no longer concerned just with individual rights, it's also concerned with group rights, children, women, refugees, and the disabled. It's no longer concerned either with just negative obligations, protecting the individual from the state. It's also concerned with positive obligations. So the United Nations Human Rights Committee has observed that the right to life not only protects against the death penalty and arbitrary executions, it also is concerned with positive obligations in relation to the rights to life, the prevention of infant mortality, the prevention of epidemics, all of which have resource implications. Indeed, some states have conceptualized the protection of economic and social rights as part of the core identity of the state and as a no-go area for multinationals, because they regard economic, social, and cultural rights as placing the limits on globalization. Again, in South Africa, 38 pharmaceutical companies, together with the Pharmaceutical Association, an international body, very powerful group of multinationals, sought to strike down provisions of the South African Medicine and Related Substances Act. In particular, they sought to strike down the provisions prohibiting sampling, prohibiting bonuses, prohibiting incentives, and they wanted to strike down a system of pricing that was transparent and a system which allowed the generic production of medicines. Now, the South African government fought the case, both on the basis of its own policy, but they were very aware, as they stated, of the international ramifications of this case on the developing world. And so great had this caught the public imagination that, in fact, there was mass media protest, and the pharmaceutical companies had to withdraw. They were undoubtedly the stronger of the two parties, but they had to withdraw from the case. And I think the withdrawal by the pharmaceutical company, A, is very empowering, but it also shows what developing states can do if they have strong protection of economic, social, and cultural rights in their constitutions. Now, human rights are generally perceived by governments to be swords against them, but they can also be used as shields. Article 28 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child requires the 191 states' parties to provide all children with free primary education, to make secondary education progressively free, and to make higher education, please note the United Kingdom government, progressively free on the basis of capacity and accessible to all. These are binding legal obligations on a state. And as I've said, they place limits on a state's budgetary policy. So I think it's arguable that it's not open for a state to accept loan agreements, adjustment policies, which involve a lowering of rights of children in relation to their right to education. The states can use the treaty as a shield, arguing that they're quite willing to repay at specific rates, but they cannot breach their treaty obligations, to put it in simple terms. Now, education entitlements in treaties can also be reconceptualized from being states' purely social and legal responsibilities to becoming diplomatic tools for states to use on their negotiations on finance agreements. But this is also binding on lending governments. Now, that distinguished organization, the IMF, has argued that it is not bound by human rights treaties. And this may be true as an organization. However, sitting on the governing boards of the IMF are states which have undertaken in their individual capacities to be bound by specific human rights treaties, including, for example, Article 28.3 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which talks about cooperation and places a duty on states to take account, particular account, of the needs of developing countries. So you can see how we should begin to explore these tools and see what potential they have for eradicating poverty. Too much attention has been focused on the conflicts between economics and human rights. And now in this millennium, I think it's time we turn a new page and begin to look at cooperation and cooperative efforts between human rights activists and economists. Thank you.
you very much. Our last speaker, our last but not least speaker, is Alfredo Sophia Yonis, who is an economist and a senior advisor to the Managing Director's Office at the World Bank. His work at the World Bank has focused on human rights and the social dimensions of globalization. He has worked on sustainable development in the environment, agriculture and rural development in West Africa and human rights. And he has also made contributions in the areas of poverty eradication, the financing of development, gender and women's issues, and indigenous rights. And for 8 years, he represented the World Bank at the UN on human rights issues.
Thank you very much. I am deeply honored by this invitation to come here to the London School of Economics. I must say that one of the reasons I wanted to be here is to hear my fellow economists as to how they feel about human rights and economic development, because in the 8 years that I've been at the United Nations representing the bank, I've sort of been the lonely economist trying to not only contribute but also rebuttal some of the issues that have been put there together. I must say that it is fundamental, this seminar, to look at the synergies of human rights and economic development. But most specifically, I think, for a university like this, to look at the synergy between human rights and welfare economics in its core. The issue is extremely controversial, and I think this demands a very rigorous analysis if we're not going to lose the boat at this particular juncture. My presentation is one that it will say similar things, but one thing I want to point out is that it has to be a two-way street. It's not only convincing the economist to take this, but also lawyers need to listen to economists to realize that some of the concepts that are there might need some transformation as they want us to transform our own framework. Secondly, it's no news to you that the bank is often behind and late in getting into these issues. So I hope that what I will share with you today might be of some interest to you, maybe not. But basically, I'll try to share with you a number of issues that we are confronted as an institution, as an economic institution in the issue of rights, and what we have done to date. And then maybe I will also carve a little bit on welfare economics and where maybe welfare economics should go to involve human rights into itself. This is not the first time that actually economists are challenged. I mean, I remember I've been 28 years at the World Bank, and I was the first environmental economist the bank hired in 1975. I have not forgotten the battles with economists, so they will understand the concept of natural capital. The controversy is not over, but the battle between ecologists and environmentalists and economists was almost an impossible one, and it took 11 years since I joined the bank to create the environmental department. So these issues are not just superficial issues, they are very entrenched in the way economists think. Let me start with some sort of an institutional view and give you a little bit of a where do we fit within the system, the multilateral system, because this is important. First of all, I like to say to you that despite of our delays in acting, I believe that the World Bank could make a major contribution in the issue of rights. And I believe also something that might be not agreeable to you, that we have done, in fact, a major contribution to the implementation of all rights, not only economic, social, and cultural rights, but also civil and political rights, and I will illustrate. And this is the issue that the first speaker mentioned, that not using the language doesn't mean necessarily that we are not doing anything on human rights. The second thing which is very important to note is that it is clear that the implementation of rights requires an action in all sectors of the economy. Right to health is not only for the Minister of Health, is not only for the health sector. It is impossible to really attain rights of education, health, housing, and you name it, obviously right to development, without looking at all sectors of the economy. And here, I think many of the human rights advocates need to change a little bit their views on how they feel about economic growth, because in most of the debate I've been, economic growth seems to be a negative thing. Economic growth seems to be a total contradiction and a source of human rights violation. I think some of this have been changed. I mean, if you look at the report by independent expert, like in Right to Development, this issue of the importance of economic growth come, you know, central to the arguments of Right to Development. But I think that it's important to think about this issue of how to implement these rights. The second point that I want to make is that beside the hardcore things that the bank does, the brick and mortar, I think most of you who have been relatively informed of the last changes in the last decade, the bank has really got involved in issues of processes and issues of outcome. Clearly, there is an empowerment policy, and for those of you who read what comes out of the World Bank, you can compare the World Development Report of 1990 on poverty and the World Development Report of the year 2000 on the same issue. They're years apart, not only in terms of the thinking, but also in terms of the language that is behind them. So it is also important in this first part for me to tell you that the real challenge for the bank and for myself personally as the advisor on human rights is to define where human rights fit in an economic institution like the bank. This is not a trivial thing. The answers to this are not very trivial if you look at who is in charge of what within the United Nations system. And we don't want to really have the World Bank to play the role of the Office of the High Commissioner or the Office of the Commission on Human Rights or the subsidiary bodies of the UN or policing rights or monitoring rights. This is a very important point. How do you bring more coherence in the system with value added and not just say, well, we embrace human rights and we begin to step on the toes of someone else? We are very engaged in the last 2 years into human rights within the World Bank. We have not put out this in the internet too much. We have not sort of advertised or communicated too much on it. But there have been a lot of things happening in the World Bank lately. And let me just share, I'm terrible for advertising the bank. I hate to do this, but some information is needed here before we enter into a dialogue. First, Mr. Wolfenson, in his last speech in the annual meetings in Dubai, has expressed statement on the World Bank and human rights, and I will encourage you to really look at it. In fact, it even endorses right to development. Secondly, the managing director and vice president of IFC, which is the International Finance Corporation, the sort of the private sector arm of the bank, in the last 2 weeks has come out and say, we are going to follow as an investment criteria the triple bottom line, which means profit, social, and environment. And within the social, we are going to incorporate fully the issues of human rights in private sector investment. This is totally new, and you have read probably the Financial Times and others which have put this information out. To me, this is a fundamental landmark in my work after 8.5 years of trying to push the issue of human rights within the bank. Not less important is that as of last week, every vice presidency of the World Bank has a focal point on human rights. So if you knock the door now of the Bank on Human Rights, there will be someone else in Africa or in Latin America who is going to talk to you about human rights. This is a thing which is fundamental. So there are like 24 people now fully engaged on this issue of human rights. If you look at the guidelines that the bank has for the poverty strategy, now the bank has adopted a chapter that includes issues of human rights in poverty assessment. Now, this chapter on poverty assessment and human rights was jointly prepared by the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights and the World Bank. It's not only a work by us at the World Bank. Let me enter now very quickly, as I see time running, you know, on my second part of the presentation, on many of the issues economists tell me they have with this issue. I think we should not gloss over that there is a problem in language and there is a problem in thinking. I think to just say, let's get together and walk hand in hand is not as easy as it looks like. The first thing I like to share with you is that, as I said before, one of the key problems for economists is that the debate on human rights has been heavily dominated by lawyers and human rights advocates. And we need to change this, and we are doing this, and we are preparing conferences in which economists will be 90% of the audience. There's no point in having the Minister of Justice to proclaim human rights when the Minister of Finance is not in the same room, when the Minister of Planning is not in the same room, and so these things don't work out. I just come from Ghana, and we organized a conference in which the key speaker of the conference was the Minister of Finance of Ghana. And I think this is where we need to begin to percolate down on this issue. So there is a huge language and knowledge gap into it. I have surveyed many audiences, and I have asked audiences of advocates as well as economists, who has read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it's really people are very shy, 90% of the audience have never read it. Who has read the Covenants on Civil and Political Rights or Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights? You get less people saying that they have. Who has read the commentaries to the Covenant? So to the operational definition is right, you find practically nobody reading this. Nevertheless, there are very hard positions on this. The second issue is that many of the development institutions, including the World Bank, has moved into normative economics. And this is an opportunity more than anything else. You know, we are dealing with issues of empowerment, gender equality, social justice systems, minorities, you know, children's rights, labor rights, and so on. But we don't have a strong framework for normative welfare economics. There is still a lot of discussions about what this means and how to make this decision. Just think for a moment about the Millennium Development Goals and the Millennium Declaration. It's the most normative declaration that the states have ever made. Now, where is human rights in the Millennium Development Goals? Where is it in the declaration? These are very fundamental issues where we need to dig into this. I must say that another fundamental thing that I face with my fellow economists is that economists are much at ease in dealing with rights from people to things. And some examples have been given before on property rights. You know, this is not new. We know all of this. But economists have a very serious problems in dealing with the rights of people to people. And I think we need to see where is it that we can move the agenda to be able to bring normativity, not only as a sake of normativity, but normativity as affecting and conditioning economic efficiency, comparative advantage, productivity, and all these concepts. The other area where we are having some difficulties is on two things that are fundamental that people refuse to discuss. One is what constitutes a human right, and two, what constitutes a violation to human rights. I remember asking this in the United Nations when I arrived there, and I was told that I have not done the homework. So I went to do the homework. So I did a lot of homework for a year, and part of my homework was to ask the experts as to how they define human rights, or how do they define violation of human rights. And I'm not lying, everyone told me a different story. And so we have an issue here as to why this is important for economists. It's important for economists because many economists have come out in writing saying human rights are actually entitlements. And this is not correct. If human rights are actually entitlements, then we have an issue in the way economists do public expenditure reviews and macroeconomic management. This is a big thing. Now, when someone violates rights, people tell me all the time that there are human rights violations when they don't like the development outcome they see. But this is not necessarily a reason for violating rights. We need to go much deeper into that. And one of the key things that I've been studying myself personally in my own intellectual journey is the distinction between the public good nature and the private good nature of rights. And in order to answer whether you violate human rights in the spirit of the declaration or not, many advocates and many lawyers do not make that distinction. But the examples they use on justiciability are 100% public good nature of rights, not private good nature of rights. And here is something that probably some university might like to look into this. The next problem we have among us economists and lawyers is to the instrument. What is the best package of instrument that will allow societies to fulfill the rights? Now, economists, naturally, this is our bread and butter. We believe in the market. Lawyers don't believe in the market. They believe in social processes, in political processes. So the question is here, how do we bring political economy to bear in between us, lawyers and economists? And political economists have become very shy also in this matter. So it's not only a question of economists and lawyers, but also bring political scientists into this issue, because otherwise it's not going to happen. One of the ways this manifests is on the very negative view that people have about privatization of human rights, on macroeconomic management of human rights. And I can go on and on and on this. The last issue that I'd like to share with you is about how to measure the effects of violation of rights. Most lawyers and advocates only look at the first round effects. If someone got employed, you violated their rights. If the economy goes down for a while to be better off in the future, is not good. If the budget goes down for 2-3 years, this is a violation of rights. But unfortunately, I wish economists had the toolkit that is always win-win. In other words, that never the economy will make anyone worse off. And here there is a very interesting concept in welfare economics, which is very different from what lawyers think about rights. Lawyers do not accept the violation of anyone's rights. Economists do. Economists say that if the society as a whole can be better off, some people may be worse off. It's a matter of compensation. This is not an acceptable thing. And if you read the last report on the right to development, the vector and the way an advancement on right to development is defined in very traditional Pareto optimal. That is to say, someone needs to be better off and nobody worse off. And this is a very difficult criterion to fulfill. Let me end and go down very quickly on two issues that you asked me to talk about, which was trade liberalization and globalization. These are non-ending issues, and I don't think I have much to add to what you as an audience already know. There is an issue as to how one really analyzes liberalization of trade and the violation of human rights. Unfortunately, for many people, there are many domino chips between trade liberalization and the violation of rights. And this has been terribly explained by advocates. The only argument that comes in very strongly is always the argument of the budget. You know, how do you allocate budget into education, health, nutrition, and food security and housing? But actually, there is much more than that that we need to analyze on trade liberalization and human rights, and not much has been done. For example, the question of timing and the asymmetry of timing of policies and protection of rights. You can liberalize the right to forest products, you can liberalize the commerce of forest products, but it might take 5 minutes to do so, but it might take 20 years to really assign rights to the forest. The same thing happened with civil and political rights. You know, you might create the conditions for the growth and stabilization of the economy, but actually, you know, the fulfillment of this political and civil right might take many more years. This asymmetry in timing of policies is something that has constrained us from advancing on this. On the issue of comparative advantage and trade, you know that many economists feel that dealing with human rights in trade liberalization is polluting the commercial agreements. People don't want to discuss labor and trade, health and trade, you know, intellectual property rights and health. And this put a very interesting spin into the relative importance of international policies and domestic policies. People are saying you deal with that at the domestic level. And the problem is that the porosity that exists between international policy and domestic policy is so large that many governments don't have the mechanism to actually have good domestic policies to comply with rights because of international policy. And this is an issue that probably is also important to discuss in this university. Let me end, because I'm already over my time, by saying that I had a lot to say about welfare economics and human rights, but I don't have the time, is that the way to really conceptualize human rights in welfare economics is to assume that human rights are part of the initial endowments of people. Most of the theory of welfare economics is based on the notion of capital. We need to bring human rights as a notion of institutional capital. I remember when I brought the notion of natural capital to the World Bank, this was impossible, not accepted. At the end, you know, there has been a lot written about natural capital. I believe that the entry to positive welfare economics is to assume that human rights are in fact another form of capital. And they are very important form of capital for people who have little endowments on traditional capital, financial, and labor. And I think much more analysis needs to be done. And it's not that difficult to be done. So to end, I would say that it is fundamental, this conference. This conference is fundamental in the sense of what we are discussing, but I hope that we can continue, that this is not going to end up here, because we need at the World Bank actually to make this step, but we need to make it in a way that is consistent with an economic development institution. And I really thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Right, thank you very much, all the three speakers, for a very interesting talk. So we now have quite some time for questions. So do people have any questions? Are there roving mics? There's a first one up there. Can you say who you are as well?
My name is Wolfgang Deckers. I have a question for Mr. Sophia Yunus, in the sense that he mentioned economic growth. And I was wondering, and I think the World Bank counts tying up an oil spill as economic growth, which I think is very wrong. And I think that the World Bank hasn't got the basic categories right at all. And that means that I really think the World Bank is co-responsible for economic and political and social destruction in many countries. And that really, I'm terribly sorry to say, Mr. Safir Yunus, not just in the last 8 years, but in the last 20 years, the World Bank has failed. Wouldn't you agree with me?
Can I take several questions? Are there any other questions? One down here.
I'd like to also take up the concluding remarks of Taylor St. Louis, when he argues that human rights should be incorporated into the discourse of welfare economics as an element of capital, that I understood the term you were using. Would it be more correct to say that human rights is an element which should be incorporated into the notion of labour rather than capital? And I say that because my feeling is that much of the debates that are going on about globalisation and the role of the World Bank and the role of the International Monetary Fund is actually to provide programmes and projects and funds which are designed to incorporate vast sectors of the world population who are not economically productive as defined by capital and capitalism, i.e. to make it productive labour. It's very good to have positive educational policies built into financial loans to countries that are in need of those financial loans. It's very good to have health programs built into those loans. But the fact of the matter is that education and health for populations that do not enjoy education and health as an inherent right are, I'm afraid to say, in my view, seen as attempts to bring unproductive labor into the fold of productive labour as defined in many cases by multinational companies that are looking for cheaper sources of labour. Thank you.
Can I have one lady?
I probably don't need the microphone.
Well, no, I was going to take the one behind you.
My name is Alexandra Maltseva. I'm a third year student. And my question is, whether international institutions like the Court of Human Rights, for example, they have any means of reinforcement of their decisions, and how successful are those means? Thank you.
I'll take one more question and then get the speakers to answer and then take some further questions.
My name is Andy. I want to exercise my human rights, so I want to have my freedom of speech here. So I want to ask two questions. The first question I want to ask Professor Tim Murphy from the first speaker. I really appreciate your research finding, but sometimes we measure the happiness and human rights in compared to China and India. Everyone knows China and India are very big countries. How many samples are you measure or you really question about them? Because you can't ask more than 1%. If you ask 1% of people, how can you know the whole population people? Because you sample size only 1%. How can you know the reality? Because in doing social science statistics, academic research, you should be more objective, and your findings sometimes have big digression and lead you to some finding not reliable. This is some problem and limitation in my finding. Also, when you compare two countries, you can't ask, because two countries different in culture, belief, religion. You can't compare and define the happiness very easily, or human rights very easily, because people have different beliefs. Also, the two countries, you can't compare two countries because totally sometimes very difficult for social science. But this is the first question, okay. The second question is about the World Bank, the last speaker. I don't know, because human rights normally the area in political leader and national leader. I don't know how much economic people can do. Did World Bank cooperate with the national leader and political leader in the country and do some human rights building or liberty building project? Because if you do the money, I don't think you can have effective outcome. Thank you.
Can I'm going to ask the speakers now to respond to those questions and then take some. Who wants to start? The first question was, has the World Bank failed?
First of all, I think that in terms of whether we have failed or not, I don't know if the question was as an institution and what a large, or if we have failed in the context of human rights. I tried to be as genuine as possible in answering your question. On the first part of whether one measures a spillover of oil as a GMP, this is an anachronism of national accounts, not only at the World Bank, you know, this is everywhere. Clearly, that doesn't mean that we are sort of ignoring the environmental impacts of development, or if we are ignoring this type of externalities. In fact, we are the largest lender in the world on environmental projects, and I can say that with a lot of pride and also a little bit tired after 20 years fighting for this. I mean, we have more than $600 billion in projects at this point in time in the world on issues of that sort. In fact, many of the profits of the World Bank are allocated to the protection of national parks and ecologically fragile areas in the world. I think our record on the environment is fairly good, so much so that we don't have such a flack from the NGO community lately on the role of the bank on the environment. This issue is not at the top of the agenda. In fact, the issue that is at the top of the agenda of NGOs is human rights more than really dealing with the World Bank on environment. On the second part of your question, we are doing a lot on civil and political rights. We are not calling them civil and political rights. But for example, the bank at this point has 67 projects dealing with the reform of justice systems. We have around 90 projects of anti-corruption. We have a large number of projects on gender equity. I think people need to get a little bit more informed of what we are doing, and in part it's our fault not to have a good communication strategy with you. But basically, even on civil and political rights, the bank is doing quite a bit to make it work. Now, do we fail in development? Certainly we do. We fail in development for many reasons. One, because sometimes we are ignorant, and we pretend we know the answers to the questions that we are in front of us. But I would say that is the least number of times that we do that. I think we fail in development because development is extremely complex, and the bank is involved exactly in the areas where nobody wants to be involved. You know, in many cases when there are crises, the private sector leaves, the private banks go away, and that's the time when the bank comes in, when the risks are higher and when the chips are down. We get into issues of adjustment when the economy is not doing well. So, you know, we are taking risks. Last but not least, because economics in itself is a very limited science for prediction and doing other things. So yes, we make mistakes and we fail, but I think overall, the bank has had an incredible record in the last 56 years. On the second question dealing with capital, I think I like your point of view. I accept your point of view. I think my problem was that I was rushing to finish the presentation when I saw that I was out of time. I did a research in 1985 to 1987 looking at 2,000 projects that have been completed in the realm of bank financing. And I did a study on sustainability. What came out of this project is that essentially, to maintain economic sustainability, you needed to focus not only on one form of capital, but on six forms of capital: physical, financial, human, which is labor and another thing, cultural, institutional, and when we discussed the issue of institutional capital, we particularly put in the issues of norms, rules, and regulation. But this notion of institutional capital or endowment has not been developed. It was really aggregated into social capital. And by aggregating into social capital, you lost really in the aggregation the nature and scope of this form of capital. And I think my idea was to disaggregate it again and really look into it with much more specificity. On the issue of how much means there is for enforcement of human rights, this is a fundamental issue that you are asking. I don't have the answer, but I can tell you the history of it. The bank failed in using conditionality in development. And it's very difficult now that the pendulum has swung against conditionality to bring conditionality back in the context of human rights. So there is an issue here on how you actually enforce this. But I want to be very categorical. It's not the job of the bank to enforce human rights. we as an institution don't have that mandate. We were not created with that mandate. In fact, history tells us that the bank, the IMF, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came at the same time, and the creation of the bodies around this came at the same time with the view that they were complementary bodies. It's up to the Commission on Human Rights to make sure that the countries, and the obligations are obligations of the state to comply with these rights.
Geraldine, do you want to say something about justice, stability, and enforcement?
Can I say something about the World Bank and its obligations in relation to human rights treaties? Because I think one has to make a distinction between the World Bank as a corporate organization, but it is made up of states and state representatives. They're not making up the policy on an individual basis. And as you rightly pointed out, states are bound by these human rights treaties, including duties of international cooperation, including duties which mean they don't violate a number of rights. There is a feeling of a perception of failure when it comes to the World Bank. I don't think all of it is justified. I think the World Bank is changing. But I still fundamentally don't understand why the World Bank can't acknowledge that it is not bound by human rights treaties, or at least I don't mind the language that you use, but the obligations enshrined in those treaties.
I think this is a very important question, and I think the jury is out there. I don't think there is a final answer to this. It has to do with issues like whether international law should be subsidiary to humanitarian law and so on. I've been in many of these debates. I must say to you the following. First of all, that the bank do recognize the treaties signed by countries. It does. And we are not binding the countries from coming to the World Bank and saying, we like to comply with this treaty. Can you give us money to do education and health? And we are not saying no to them. In fact, we are absolutely open to this. But I want to tell you something which is very telling, and is the following. A year and a half ago, President Wolfensohn, the president of the World Bank, went to the board. The board of the World Bank is the authorizing environment for us, staff members. I'm not the World Bank. I'm a staff member of the World Bank. The World Bank is the government that really owns the World Bank. And they're sitting in 24 chairs at the board of the World Bank. Mr. Wolfensohn, as part of the corporate strategy, brought three issues to the board for approval. The dialogue with faith groups, secondly, cultural development, and third, human rights. A year and a half ago, by a vote of 24-0, he was told not to do anything on these three areas. It was not an issue of developed country, developing country, north, south. I feel that I'm from a developing country, and I should have. On the contrary, many of the middle-income countries and many of the low-income countries were very, very much against the bank dealing with human rights. But I can assure you that these things are changing. And in fact, it's my role in the near future to go back to the board and make the case for it. And really, the reason why I'm here is to learn more so the case is stronger and not just an advocacy, because the board doesn't want an advocacy. What were the arguments against it? Number one, that the bank is doing too many things, and to do one more is mission creep. So they did not understand really the human rights as a body of values, as a vision of society. They understood it as another obligation. Secondly, many countries claim that human rights are subject to cultural relativity, and that this is a view of the Western world, and that you are imposing this view on us. Third, they don't want the bank to use its lending program as a leverage to really make countries to comply with human rights. So there were a lot of the traditional arguments there. I just want to share that it's not us not wanting. The authorizing environment is not yet ready to really let us go on this issue.
Yeah, I want to actually, I can't resist following up a little bit on that theme, since it seems to be something people want to talk about. I remember when the Bank's 2000 WDR came out, the one that put, if you like, empowerment on the anti-poverty agenda, there were sort of two reactions in among what you might call hardcore economists. One was that empowerment was sort of like motherhood and apple pie. We could all mouth it, but it didn't really mean anything. And indeed, that was there was a kind of a genuineness behind that, in the sense of saying anybody can think of this as the kind of thing that we're all in favor of, but it's the operationalization that matters. And really what you need to get down to is what exactly does this mean in context A and context B? That's why I like the panchayat experiment in India. That seems to me, when I talk to people about empowerment who even reject it, they accept that that's something that's really quite concrete, quite specific, something they can latch on to. The other reaction was the reaction that this was a step beyond core competence. And so far as the bank was good at anything, it was not good at pushing forward these other social agendas. And that it had both in the form of its historical practice in lending, much more experience in dealing with things like infrastructure projects, health, education. But this was a step too far, and I'm sure you're familiar with that debate when it comes to human rights. But it is true that organizations have to have, I mean, this is kind of business school speak, but I believe it, core competence in doing something. And I think the bank has to make a decision about where that lies. You did touch on the kind of cultural relativity argument which came from up there. I should just correct the speaker, though. I mean, this is based on a nationally representative sample survey. The World Value Survey is not based on, I mean, of course, in a country like India or China, to be nationally representative, you need a very large sample. And these are samples of the size of 7,000, not in a large country. But this is a perfectly intellectually respectable way to study the issue of how people value these things. Now, there may be cultural relativity in the way people value stuff, but I can tell you there are lots of you can look across cultures. One thing that's true is people who have more resources within a given culture repeatedly show them, on any indicator of well-being you look at, appear to have more of it. Now, that may be something as economists which we may think, or others may think, they're deluded, but there are just empirical regularities in the way people answer questions in sample surveys that as social scientists stare us in the face, and I don't think can be simply neglected as some kind of culturally irrelevant findings. And so I do think it would be a mistake to cast aside the kind of things we find in survey data when we ask people about how much do you value human rights. We tend to want to elevate that to the top of the tree, but the evidence may be that if you offer people a trade-off here, they're willing to take it. They may be willing to trade off consumption for the violation or the certain of their rights. That's something we have to encounter as a reality. If we don't, I think survey data I've seen suggests that that's a deluded position.
Let's take another round of questions. I'll say the Court of Human Rights.
There is no one single Court of Human Rights. Okay, it's not like the World Court. There's the European Court of Human Rights, there's the African, and the Inter-American. There is none in Asia. Asian political leaders have argued on the basis of cultural relativity, but I'm not aware of any culture that denies dignity as an essential facet. People do use the cultural, there's genuine issues surrounding cultural relativity, but there are those who use cultural relativity to advance their own political causes.
I'm going to take some quick questions and then we can all go for a drink. Can I have a man at the back? Could you use the microphone?
Hello, my name's Neil, I'm a third year law student, and my question is, how do you reconcile a historically contingent and westernized discipline such as the economics with like a universalistic and transcendental and idealistic conception such as the human rights?
Right. And the man here?
The World Bank and other international economic associations are largely unelected bodies. Is there? They make decisions, however, which fundamentally change the political, social, and human rights structures in many states. Now, is there any system of appeal against their decisions which can be enforced? And can the panel give one example of a decision of the World Bank which has been negated or modified?
And the man.
My name is Isaac, and my question goes to the World Bank representative, Mr. Alfredo. But before I pose my question, may I thank you and the World Bank for, after many years, 50 years, you have managed to pronounce the two words in English, which is human and rights. Thank you very much. And my question is, as you said, that the World Bank can really make a significant contribution in terms of human rights. That's very good. But now, do you really think that the structural adjustment programs imposed on the third world countries are going to be changed or to be adjusted in the way, specifically when it comes to cutting or reducing public expenditure in health and education? Thank you.
I'm going to ask the speakers now to respond, otherwise we'll run out of time. Questions were on universalism versus economics, democracy and structural adjustment.
Thank you. I'll answer the last two. I didn't understand very well the first one. Maybe the others can contribute. On question of the World Bank having not been elected bodies, the World Bank was created in 1944 by governments and for governments. This is a fact. The problem is that we are not in 1944, we are in 2003, and we are dealing with the problems of the people. And there is a problem of that the system as it is now is not necessarily, you know, the ones that people want to have at this point in time. We are fully aware of that. We are fully aware of this issue. But your question might also imply something that we need to reflect together, which is the legitimacy of governments. You know, I mean, there is a person there representing government X. We don't have the right to say you are illegitimate. I mean, I come from Chile, and there were times of Allende, there were times of Pinochet, and now there are times of democracy again. You know, whether bank staff had the right to say, you represent a socialist communist government, please get out of the room, or now you're a dictator, you don't belong to the bank, it's an issue which many people raise to us. We don't have an answer. We believe that we cannot start from the premise that the board of the bank is illegitimate and therefore non-democratic. I think the issue of democracy in the bank is different. I think people are saying we want the bank with more democratic voice in the bank. I don't think people are really questioning governments. I think people are saying why in the 24 chairs of the World Bank there are only two Africans represented when there are, you know, a large number of countries in Africa. Why is it that the NGO community is not represented at the World? These are the issues that people are raising. And I want to tell you that almost 7 or 8 months ago, there is a process now that has begun with the Development Committee of the World Bank. The Development Committee is sort of the committee of all the Minister of Finance with one country, one vote involved. It's a totally democratic committee that meets twice a year, spring and in the fall of every year. And we prepare papers for the Development Committee depending on what are the development issues of the time. And there is a major paper that has been discussed in Dubai on voice and democratization of the World Bank. And they have taken this over. The president of the bank is very clear that the board needs to change, that there must be more representation of Africans. But Africans are saying to us, it's not only a matter of representation, it also capacity to really engage. So we are creating not only the environment for more representation, but also the means so the countries that are to be represented there can do it effectively. There is also a discussion now in April, because the discussion was just in October, the next one is in April. And there are, in fact, people in the Development Committee, like the President of the Development Committee, who is the Finance Minister of South Africa, who is saying we should also question why is it that the World Bank president must be an American and the IMF should be a European. I'm just telling you that I feel very at ease with the question you ask. I mean, I don't feel that I need to defend the bank. I think these are realities. The reality of the 40s is different from the reality of this century, and things need to change. But one proviso I want to share with you, which when the people ask for the democratization of the World Bank, they ask for the following reasons. One, that they believe that a more democratic World Bank, one country, one vote, will have more money going into developing countries. Number two, that there will be more money to the least developing countries. Number three, that the allocation, the sectoral allocation of this money will be totally different than the one that is there. And four, that they will be able to avoid voting and conditionality in the process. My response to this is that not necessarily so. and that a democratic bank of one country, one vote, will not necessarily move more money to developing countries or more money to Africa, and so on and so forth. So I am asking the LSC to do research on alternative forms of governance. I'm very serious. On alternative forms of governance, and be able to respond to this issue, which is the form of governance that will, in fact, will enable more. Today, we have an asymmetric democracy in the world. NGOs want democratic World Bank, but they don't have democratic countries from where those NGOs come from. So even if you have a totally democratic World Bank, if there is no democracy at the national level, it will be very difficult to maintain this. So this is on the first point. On the second question on structural adjustment, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the bank has already done three reviews of the structural adjustment, and many of these structural adjustments have not yielded the result that expected. And we are aware of that. But I'd like to pass the back to you. We have failed on adjustment that deals with finance and economics. Now, I'm asking you, how would a structural adjustment look like if we base the structural adjustment on human rights? What sort of content will that structural adjustment have? I know the context of the one we have now, prices, taxes, subsidies, you know, so on. It will have, for example, changing power structures. It will have, probably, representation of minorities. It will have, for example, changes in interministerial power, relative powers. Now, if you look at the whole content of what a structural adjustment will look like from the point of view of human rights, the probability of winning on adjustment are also questionable. Countries are very reluctant to change power structure because the ones that are there in power don't want the power to be changed. I mean, just remember what happened in Durban in the conference on racism and discrimination, that, you know, many countries, this conference almost collapsed and nobody wanted to do anything. So your question is very well taken. And again, if you are interested in this, it will be interesting for some of you or yourself to really look at how would a new structural adjustment, because adjustment is a word that is now very much demeaned and sort of negative, but economies adjust every day. Social structures also adjust every day. Institutional structures also adjust every day. Well, how would you really adjust the structures of the country so human rights are implemented? That's a good piece for research also.
I'd just like to add a couple of brief final comments. One on health and education, because it's been discussed a great deal. And I do want to sort of caution against a certain kind of fetishism when it comes to the way these rights are described. A good example is, this is a big puzzle in current economics, is if you actually say, if you could achieve the educational attainment levels of the USA and Indonesia, how much of the gap between Indonesian income per capita and US income per capita do you think you'd fill? The answer is less than 10%. So you can go around advocating these rights, and you can go pushing people into school. But there's clearly a lot more going on in the structure, inside the structure of these countries and the way they operate, that one shouldn't obsess on these kinds of issues and think somehow you're unlocking the problem of economic development. That's just so naive. And so the notion that these budgets should be sacrosanct in the face of any other pressures a country faced is so immensely naive, I think, to be dangerous, that we simply don't find it persuasive. Now, everyone believes in education. I believe in education, of course, perhaps because it's my living. But I think one has to be dangerous in thinking that there are these components of rights when one looks in the data and says, how important are these quantitatively to the kinds of global problems we face? The answer is they are important. But I think it would be a dangerous fetishism to think you just fix a few of these issues and Indonesia is going to become a prosperous, free, and open nation like the United States. There's a lot more complex things going on. Everyone appreciates that. But when people describe these simplistic notions of pushing forward rights, I find it dangerous sometimes. Alternatives to forms of governance, I cannot resist saying, we have a great program going right now at the LSE on the economics of governance, which is exactly pitched at trying to understand, I think, the kinds of issues you're talking about.
Do any of the speakers want to answer the first question about economics being a Western values, whereas human rights are universal?
I think it depends on your economist, and I also think it depends on probably on your human rights lawyer. It's interesting you hear describing human rights as universal, because often they're described as Western, which is erroneous. I have to say I've heard many other economists working in economic, social and cultural rights who have very different approaches to economic, social and cultural rights. I think they would be insulted as being described as fetishists. I think they have different approaches to governance, and I think we have to bear that in mind.
Right. I think because we run out of time, we need to adjourn now to the Robinson Room on the third floor to continue this debate over a drink. I think we've had three excellent speakers tonight, and as in all good debates, it's opened up more questions than maybe we started with at the beginning, and I'd like you to thank them in the usual way. Thank you very much.